looks an ear to anyone.
Well, you got two.
Hi, I'm Stephanie Benetti, and along with Joe Montaldo, we host News on the Flip Side. Come join us every Saturday night at 7 p.m. Central for our three-hour program. We have opinions on everything, and we're not afraid to share them. False history gets made all day, every day. The truth of the new is never on the news, but you can find it here with News on the Flip Side. Remember, don't be politically correct. Just be correct. Join us.
Show and wish to join us in the chat room.
2015 edition of Global Newsmaker Focus with co-hosts Vernell and Patrice. The program is now broadcast live Thursdays from 7 p.m. to 7:55 p.m. Eastern and rebroadcast on Saturdays at 11:10 p.m. Eastern on United Public Radio and UPRN 107.7 FM New Orleans, Louisiana, and 107.9 FM and 105.3 FM Henderson, Pass Christian, Mississippi. The program's website is globalnewsmakerfocus.com. Also, the call-in number for any callers who'd like to ask questions of our wonderful guest is 504-273-7379. This program's website is globalnewsmakerfocus.com. And for now, this program's excellent co-host will be joining us for upcoming programs. She's in the room this evening. We miss her. She is a superb co-host and also a wonderful legal administrator. Now, Vernell, we are calling out to you. Now, I will be the host this evening, and my name is Patrice Sheridan. But first, some brief bio details. Our guest tonight is author, retired Colonel Richard Hobbs, who returns to give us his insights on Islam, current Middle East developments, including ISIS, its atrocities, and its asserted claims to be an Islamic state, and the regional and global reaction to ISIS, and the multinational coalition against ISIS. It is an honor to have Colonel Hobbs as a returning and featured guest on tonight's broadcast. First, I'd like to note for our listeners, and thank you again for joining us, a brief bio description of today's guest. Author, retired Colonel Richard Hobbs, is a graduate of the United States Military Academy at West Point. Selected as an original Olmsted Scholar, Hobbs received the degree of Docteur de l'Université in International Law and International Relations from the University of Lyon in France. He spent two tours of duty in Vietnam, advising Vietnamese paratroopers and serving as executive to the deputy commander in Vietnam, managing a large fire base, commanding the 2nd Battalion, 28th Infantry, and advising a Vietnamese regiment. Hobbs was an Army Research Associate at the Center for Strategic and International Studies in Washington. He has served in the Pentagon and with the Department of State as political military advisor in the Bureau of Near Eastern and South Asian Affairs. After retiring from the Army as a colonel after 27 years, he joined Teledyne, where his positions included Vice President International. He established his own consultant firm, Service International Limited, for international business development. Colonel Hobbs has taught courses in international politics and international conflict at the University of Nevada at Reno, Colonel Hobbs also has served as Assistant Professor of International Relations on the faculty of the Department of Sciences at West Point. Some of Colonel Hobbs' books include Radical Islam at War with the World, Do We Want Dimitude, Third Class Citizens, Slave Islam, or Do We Want to Be Free? It Is Our Choice, Death by a Thousand Cuts, Islam, Fiscal Responsibility, Fiscal Irresponsibility, and Other Threats to Destroy America. Next, World War IV and Beyond, Islamofascism, the Third Jihad, and Other Threats to the USA. Next, You and the New World Order. And last, book, The Myth of Victory, What is Victory in War? Now, Colonel Richard Hobbs' website can be found at coldoc.com, spelled C-O-L-D-O-C, .com. Sir, welcome to the program, Colonel Hobbs. I hope you can hear me, sir. It is our honor to have the opportunity of interviewing you for a second time. Colonel Hobbs' first interview on Global Newsmaker Focus aired this past October 11th, 2014. That program contained Colonel Hobbs' brilliant summation and details on the nature and goals of radical Islam and its major goal of a global Islamic caliphate under Sharia law. Some of these concepts are now being mirrored in the latest news articles and posts on ISIS and the Middle East situation. Welcome, Colonel Hobbs. Now we want to hear from you, sir. Our audience so wants to hear from you, not me. But my first question, Colonel Hobbs, if you can hear me, is for our listeners, Colonel Hobbs, could you again...
We're having trouble with my modem, I think. Should we use the phone call? I'm on a line to 504.
Oh, indeed, sir. That's fine, too. Joe, could we call Colonel Hobbs at that number that I noted in the box there on your IM? I am. He might be on the line right now with Stephanie. There's another show immediately following this. Well, Colonel Hobbs, let me ask you the question and see if we can hear your response. For our listeners, could you describe again the nature and radical goals of Islam? Can you hear me, sir?
Yes, you hear me at all?
Yes, very strongly, sir. Very strongly. Your first program...
I'm back to the modem, but okay.
I'll also put a major message into the station network room to call you on the phone as well. Colonel Hobbs, your first program discussed among its many points the importance of the jihad here's the question again. Colonel Hobbs, for our listeners, could you again describe the nature and radical goals of Islam? Your first program discussed among its several points. First, importance of the jihad for the establishment of a global caliphate and the global imposition of Sharia law. And two, you emphasized how Islam divides the world into the Dar al-Islam, land of submission, and the Dar al-Harb, land of war. And sir, while you're answering that, I'll send an IM to Joe.
Okay, well, that's a very interesting demonstration you put together, and it's very accurate. The jihad is a very critical part of Islam, very long history in Islam, and was almost one of the pillars. There are five pillars in Islam. It was almost the sixth one, but they couldn't agree on it at the time. I think they were afraid it might excite people too much. So what it is that Muhammad, when he created Islam, he divided the world up into believers and unbelievers. The unbelievers are infidels. They have no value. And the believers are the followers of Islam. Islam means submission, and a Muslim is one of those who has submitted. And so one of the things that we get from Muhammad is the division of the world into two parts. As you pointed out, the Dar al-Islam, that's the land that they control, and the Dar al-Harb is all the rest, which is sort of what's mine is mine and what's yours is mine also, so it's a very difficult situation to have to put it with. Can you hear me?
Yes, but very, very well. Actually, very, very well.
I don't know which one I'm on, the telephone or the other one, but anyway.
Well, you know, sir, no, the audio sounds wonderful. You sound very, very clear, very strong in your points. And secondly, you know, Colonel Hobbs, your work does describe the Islamic threat of a global Islamic caliphate. How do you perceive ISIS's asserted claim
on that? Well, I think is about as Islamic as you can get. He has established, this is Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi, has established a caliphate, which he made himself the caliph, and a lot of people are saying, well, he's just a phony, and so you can't do that. Well, I don't believe that. We use the term now Daesh, which is it's the acronym for ISIS, Islamic State in Iraq and Sham. Sham is a Levant, which is the area of Syria, Lebanon, and so on there on the Eastern Mediterranean. And that's the other term that's used, or acronym, ISIL for Levant. And then we have IS for the Islamic State. So we have three different acronyms going, and the one I prefer to use now is Daesh, which is it's the acronym in Arabic, but it has the advantage of when it's pronounced a certain way in Arabic, it becomes very pejorative. So it either means crushing something underfoot or bigots imposing their will on people. So it becomes a pejorative term, and it's, I think, a much better term to use when we're talking about the organization that Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi has put together in Syria and Iraq.
Fascinating information. I noticed, Colonel Hobbs, that the businessinsider.com had a great article posted January 23rd by journalist Jeremy Bender entitled, "A Top U.S. General Now Calls ISIS by the Name They Hate." And journalist Bender references Lieutenant General James Terry, who uses the name, sir, how do I pronounce it, Daesh?
Daesh, I'm not sure exactly how, but Daesh is good enough.
Wonderful. Well, you know, almost exclusively while discussing ISIS, I guess I hate this name, and Mr. Bender notes here, citing him directly, Terry said he had begun to use the term Daesh instead of ISIS at the request of Middle Eastern partners in the anti-ISIS coalition who wished to draw a sharp line between the group and Islam. Boy, that reasoning sounds good to me, and I guess Prime Minister Tony Abbott also is calling this group Daesh, as also U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry is also following that use of the name. And also, let me see. Oh, this is interesting. I guess ISIS supporters hate this name because it also leaves out the Islamic portion of the name. That's interesting as well. And, you know, you were mentioning Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi, that is his assumed name, claiming Quraysh descendants, being a descendant of Muhammad. Do you think other Muslims take him seriously?
Well, that's interesting. Everybody wants to be a relative of Muhammad. They want to prove that they're in that line of descent. I don't think it's possible for all of them, but a lot of them do. The kings, particularly King Abdullah over in Jordan, the Hashemites claim that they're related to the Quraysh. Abu Bakr, his original name is Ibrahim Ali al-Bakri. So al-Bakri, I don't know whether that's the name of the tribe, but it most likely is. And when you have that, that would be a connection. But, you know, it's interesting, why did this guy, Ibrahim, why did he pick the name Abu Bakr? And that's a very interesting thing, because Abu Bakr, the one that's originally and more important in Islamic history, was the first convert with Muhammad, and his daughter was Aisha, who was married to Muhammad when she was 6 years old, and so they became related. And when he died in her lap, his head in her lap, because she was his favorite wife. And Ali, his cousin, thought he was going to be the caliph, because nobody could take over for him since he was the last prophet. But the companions and the people around Muhammad, because there had been no method of succession, elected Abu Bakr. So he was the first caliph, And he saved Islam because the various tribes thought they'd had enough of this nonsense. And when Muhammad died, they went back to their old ways in the desert. And he brought them all back into the fold and smashed them pretty hard. So it's very interesting that he selects the nom de guerre of Abu Bakr, and then al-Baghdadi means from Baghdad. So Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi is his name, but that's not his real name.
So that's very, very interesting. Now, Colonel Hobbs, I hope you didn't hear me kind of have a large sigh there. My wonderful cat just jumped on the laptop, and I was afraid of his disconnecting my phone connection there. Colonel Hobbs, the reports of the atrocities committed by ISIS have been so horrific and extensive. First, the execution of the Jordanian pilot, Lieutenant Muaz al-Kasyasbeh, resulted in the rightful extreme anger of the Jordanians, and please pardon me if I mispronounce that name. Now, Colonel Hobbs, do you believe that Jordanian's King Abdullah II will be successful in his retaliatory actions against ISIS? There's a great article by Newsmax.com posted on February 4th by journalist Bernard Carrick entitled "Jordan's King Responds Swiftly to ISIS Barbarism," and it does note some interesting information. Apparently, King Abdullah II is a graduate of the Royal Military Academy of Sandhurst in the United Kingdom. Also, he served as a commander of Jordanian Special Forces before becoming king. Noting that information in the article. Well, you know, Colonel Hobbs, he's certainly a very educated and skilled monarch, and the Jordanians are strongly against ISIS now. What do you think? Do you think that the Muslims, for other people of the followers of Islam, are going to just rise up against this horrific group, ISIS?
Well, Abdullah is a good guy. I met him when he was a teenager, and he was going to prep school here in the United States, and the Jordanian attaché was responsible to King Hussein to take care of the boy. And we were over at Jordanian attaché's home one day, and the kids were out playing football, and they brought my daughter along as a teenager. So anyway, yes, he had a good education, good military background. He was the head of special forces. He was a general. And when King Hussein was in very bad health at the end, instead of naming his brother to be his successor, he named Abdullah to take over as king. The death of the pilot is a very interesting thing. It helps King Abdullah because it brought strong feelings across the country of set aside our differences for the moment. We don't like this bunch of guys that killed one of our pilots. And one of the very interesting things about this killing, when he was burned to death very brutally, is that the state of Qatar over on the Persian Gulf had a fatwa, number 17480, which was put out some years ago, and it referred to Abu Bakr, the actual Abu Bakr back to the first caliph, approving death by fire. Interestingly, this fatwa, or religious declaration, was withdrawn within hours of the video coming out. So there's some interesting things that are going on with all of that.
Well, you know, not to be graphic, Colonel Hobbs, but there has been a good deal of media coverage about different experts saying that fire is forbidden in the Quran. Of course, ISIS has its ridiculous justification for these killings by fire. Other individuals have also been executed in this manner, saying that they represent air attacks on ISIS locations. But, you know, here I've got a key comment. Am I correct here that ISIS uses prisoners as human shields when ISIS thinks there will be an attack on a particular ISIS location?
Well, if I understand it, yes, they use human shields, but the argument they were using was an eye for an eye. The use of the pilots and the airplanes by dropping napalm or anything that's explosive in fire, then the pilot could be killed by fire was their justification for it.
Boy, that's interesting. And, you know, CNN reported in an article this past Thursday, let me see, it was entitled activist. ISIS now holds 262 Christian hostages in Syria by journalist Laura Smith Spark. Unfortunately, they're saying now that 262 Syrians are being held by ISIS, and indeed Osama Edward, founder of the Assyrian Human Rights Network, is claiming that this Sunni extremist group, meaning ISIS, now holds 262 Assyrian captives. There have been reports in the media they're really fearing for these people, that they'll be used as human shields and then executed.
The latest number, it was 350, but then about 19 of them were released for some reason, which might just be good PR. You know, to go with that, what's important about it is these people are Assyrians. And the Assyrian city of Nimrud was just bulldozed yesterday, which is an ancient city going back to about the 13th century B.C. It's on the Tigris River, close to southeast of Mosul. So it goes in, it fits in with what you're going to want to get into again, and that is all of this other business that's happening with the destruction. But the whole business of the Christians is bad. And then you've got, of course, the Christians at the execution that we had in Libya, which I think you want to talk about.
Yes, sir. There's been much coverage of the beheading of the 21 Coptic Egyptian Christians on that Libyan beach. Now, at the NewYorkDailyNews.com, there's a great article entitled Pope Francis Declares Them Martyrs. The article itself is entitled Pope offers mass for 21 beheaded Egyptian Christians, calls them martyrs, and the journalist for that is Deborah Hastings. It was posted February 17th. And just two little bulletins from that article, he, meaning Pope Francis, asked that the Lord welcome them as martyrs, quoting the Pope, and on Monday he called the horrific killings a barbaric assassination. Now, you know, Pope Francis is scheduled to address both Congress and the United Nations later this year. I wonder if he's going to pointedly mention the ISIS threat, as well as the Pope's other concern about global warming and the environment.
Well, he's worried about a lot of things, but, you know, the interesting thing about that execution of the 21 Coptic Christians on the beach in Libya was how much it was orchestrated for television.
Yes, for their video, the ISIS video.
A very orchestrated thing. They were all in very fresh, nicely clean, bright uniforms in orange. The men behind them were in nice, fresh, black uniforms, one per cop, and they marched them out, a very orchestrated situation. Then the one man, Jihadi John, I guess it is, or an American, whichever it was, then gave a speech, which of course was recorded. That means you have to have a television crew there, right there. This is very advanced technology. And so then within an hour or two, the video is released on the World Wide Web for everyone to see. This is very sophisticated propaganda. Very sophisticated.
Indeed, Colonel Hobbs, you mentioned their use of high technology, state-of-the-art video, or at least very high technology in their video productions. But, you know, sort of segue into that point, there is a website entitled Shoebot, shoebat.com, and I just want to advise parents on the our listeners that I have not watched the video yet. I have a feeling that's going to be very graphic. I will, but you want your children to watch. It will be very upsetting for them. But now in an article by Waleed Shoebot, he says that initially, I thought it was only one of the Coptic Christian Egyptians who were beheaded had called out the name of Christ. But apparently, from this article by Waleed Shoebot, many—now, of course, this is being videotaped by ISIS—many of these Coptic Christian Egyptians about to be beheaded were saying the name of Christ, at least mouthing the name of Christ as they were beheaded. Perhaps by that point they'd lost their vocal cords. But I guess even under the blade, some were making their last prayers, and as the blade came to their neck, they all cried in unison, Ya Rabbi Yasu, Oh My Lord Jesus, I hope I correctly pronounced that. And, of course, in that videotape, the caption by ISIS is, others assert, says, these insisted to remain in unbelief. In other words, they, and the journalist here is adding, the caucus were given the option to convert or die, and every one of them refused even unto death. That's a really powerful witness.
It's powerful, isn't it? But that is to Islam again. The verdict for any prisoner is normally convert or die. The one exception is for Christians, Jews, and some Zoroastrians, Persians, a sect. And they were given the extra option of submitting and becoming a dhimmi. In this case, I don't think they were given that option. It was either convert or die, because the Muslims do not like the Copts, but they don't like any Christians, so it's not very different. A very brutal scene. All 21 were beheaded right on the beach, and then a lot of blood in the water, so it made for good video for people who like that sort of thing.
Well, you know, a further article on this is by journalist Jordan Chattel, posted February 5th at Breitbart, Breitbart.com. It's entitled, ISIS Beheads 21 Christians, Promises to Conquer Rome by Allah's Permission. And quoting the journalist directly, the Islamic State terror group released a video, you were referencing this, Colonel, on Sunday, showing the Islamic jihadis beheading 21 Egyptian Christians who were previously kidnapped in Libya, end quote. And let me see. Oh, and you're referencing that the media, the professional media group, further quoting the journalist, Mr. Chateau, the Islamic State's Al-Hayat media, the group that has published the previous beheading videos in the Middle East, produced the Libya video titled, A Message Signed with Blood to the Nation of the Cross, end quote. And, you know, in this video, too, I guess, and here further quoting the journalist, citing, after the ISIS leader finishes speaking, his fellow terrorists then commence the beheading of the 21 Egyptian Christians, and now quoting these terrorists, and we will conquer Rome by Allah's permission, the promise of our prophet, peace be upon him, the militant leader says after his comrades slaughter the Christian hostages, end quote. Well, you know, many journalists are referencing this conquering Rome concept, and, you know, a Twitter comment was noted, Ray ISIS and coming for Rome, but some journalists question if it is Rome as in the papal state, or is it the West in general, or specifically the United States?
Well, conquering Rome is a constant theme that is, you see it regularly in Islamic writing. Some of the time it's talking about Rome, some of the time it's talking about the West, and some of the time it's talking about Europe. What it is, you're going back to the times when this started, you're talking about the Roman Empire. So Rome was an empire, and important to remove the Roman Empire. They never got into Italy in any strength, but they got into it a little bit, but they never conquered Italy. But they did get up into Spain and so on. But this comes up regularly. I've seen it with the Imam of the King Fahd Defense University, Yusuf Ekaradawa, uses, we will return to Rome, meaning Europe in his case, saying we'll get there with teaching. We won't even have to use the sword because we're going to take over Europe. The Turkish Prime Minister has used it. So it is a recurrent theme of we will conquer Rome. We will come back to Rome. And I think in the general sense, it means we're going into Europe. I think that's their first meaning of it.
You know, sir, that's very, very interesting information. I will be mentioning Europe next, but I just wanted to also briefly note, and I correct, the Egyptians sent an air attack response against ISIS in Libya. Now, wasn't this in conjunction with anti-Libyan government elements there? Darn, I should have got the news article on that. But the Egyptians apparently are not standing down with this ISIS murder of their countrymen. There was further coverage as well, that these laborers were wonderful family men. They were just in Libya trying to get money for their families at home.
Yeah, they were just laborers. And General al-Sisi, the president now of Egypt, did put an airstrike or more immediately into Libya. Libya is another one of those good places that doesn't have a government. Ever since we managed to overthrow Gaddafi, there has not been a substantial government that can control the country. And we have now, Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi has a group in the Benghazi area which has sworn allegiance to Daesh. So he has a branch now. He has branches in various places, which we can cover later. But this there that was involved with the beheadings is evidently what they now call a province or a part of the Islamic State.
Colonel Hobbs, your work on the Muslim attempt at a social-cultural invasion of Europe specifically mentions the Islamic impact on France. At your coldoc.com site, there's an excellent article on the French situation. It's entitled, French Problems, Are They World Problems? It's dated January 17th, 2013, a very prescient article. Now, okay, if I'm correct here, the attack on the French satirical magazine Charlie Hebdo, the killing of the editor and many staff members, as well as the grocery store killings in Paris, have provoked a strong suspicion that Al-Qaeda and ISIS were linked in both tragedies. I know there's one website, Inquisitor.com, has an interesting article on this. And also we had that recent Danish event when a Danish cartoonist was the subject of an assassination attempt while attending a conference. Apparently, one of his cartoons had a negative depiction of, I believe it was Muhammad.
Well, poor old Muslims, they have such a terrible ego problem, they just can't stand any criticism. Every little cartoon turns them into raving maniacs, so they've got a psychological mental problem. But yes, the whole thing that, the question of Al-Qaeda and IS working together. They're not working together at this time. You might recall that when Abu Bakr first, he was the head of what was called ISI at the time, Islamic State in Iraq, left over from the war when we were fighting over there. And then in 2012, he took that into the battle in Syria. And that's when he established the Islamic State of Iraq and al-Sham, or Syria, sometimes said. He got in a fight with Ayman al-Zawahiri, the head of al-Qaeda, because he wasn't cooperating, as far as Zawahiri wanted, with the al-Nusra Front, which was his main effort in Syria. And so it got so bad that he finally said, okay, you're not a part of Al-Qaeda. So Al-Qaeda and IS have split. They are not together. What brings them together and what you were talking about, though, is in the Charlie Hebdo attack, of the three people, two of them had trained in Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, AQAP, down in Yemen. They had spent some time down there, and the other one had been to Syria and had a little bit of training with ISIS. So the training was there, but not the two organizations. The two organizations were not cooperating in France.
Thank you for clarifying that for me. Appreciate it, Colonel Hobbs. And, there was a recent news article showing French air support for the coalition efforts against ISIS, and apparently the French have very strongly reacted against this terrorist and encroachment and the terrorist acts there. And I've noticed another article claiming a new focus on using the Daesh name. Have you heard that?
No, I didn't see that one, but okay, go ahead.
But I know that there was a recent news article. It was just one. I should actually have the article referenced here directly. But I remember seeing in one of the major news groups that showing the French air support for the coalition efforts against ISIS.
Yeah, French have been doing some work in there. Their main effort, I believe, has been in Syria, but it's not clear exactly where they are. But there is a French, the French support, there's a and the Jordanian support.
You've been listening.
Very interesting. Well, you know, Colonel Hobbs, I think you mentioned this earlier in this discussion. Do you think the atrocities of ISIS have prompted a significant number of Westerners now to disregard any Islamic criticism of unfair terms or any terms used regarding them or their background? But that argument of theirs is just is going to fall on deaf ears.
Well, I'm not sure what the impact is. I would hope that all these videos would get the Americans' attention and they wake up. But we've had some atrocities for years and years, and Americans won't wake up. I mean, we blew up the World Trade Center. Okay, we got all excited for a couple weeks or a couple months and went back to sleep. And we had beheadings constantly. It's not anything new. It's gone on regularly, and Americans have not really responded. So I'm still pessimistic as to whether the Americans are waking up. I don't think they see the threat yet of Islam. The threat is not the Islamic State. The threat is Islam. That's the question.
And you know, Colonel Hobbs, last discussion, then let's go directly into ISIS after this. We had touched on ISIS's various sources for funding. There's an interesting article at CNN.com dated October 7th, 2014. It was entitled "Self-Funded and Deep-Rooted, How ISIS Makes Its Millions" by Scott Bronstein and Drew Griffin, CNN Investigations. And it's really, it's amazing. I guess they're noting that ISIS does make about $100 million per day. It has several revenue sources, including oil smuggling, organized crime, and for example, with the oil smuggling, apparently the oil source are refineries and wells that ISIS has gained control over in northern Iraq and northern Syria. And it, the article notes that it was easy for a while to smuggle the oil into quiet parts of southern Turkey. Hopefully that situation has changed. But also, from other articles, they're mentioning that other articles mention extortion, also human slave trade, human slave trafficking, horrible activities.
Well, funding is a fundamental thing. You don't run a war without money. Somebody has to buy all those Toyota pickup trucks, all those AK-47s, all those uniforms, all that, all the ammunition that they spend. Some of it was stolen from the Iraqis when they folded in Mosul, but that doesn't take care of the AK-47s. So, yes, and this is the whole argument when people say the Islamic State is not a state. Well, what is a state? A state is an organization that has to provide some services. Now, an insurgency does not go around providing services. They hit and run and hide. They don't take care of the water, the sewer, the street lights, the transportation, the courts, the food. You have to have all of these things if you're going to control an area. They control an area. Therefore, they have to provide all of that. And they do. And that's what is important. So there has to be money for that. You have to pay people. You have bureaucrats. You have somebody that's running the waterworks, running the gas stations, getting all this stuff. They've been using the old smuggling routes. Smuggling routes are famous in this area. They've been there for thousands of years, that you bring things in. But when you smuggle things, you got to pay on the barrelhead right away. You got to come up with the cash. You can't run the line of credit with these people. So they do have money. Now, as you mentioned, they were getting it from oil. It was about $1 to $2 million a day from oil. It's interestingly, they just set fire to the Azil oil field outside of Tikrit, where that battle's going on in Tikrit right now. They just set that oil field on fire. And we've been attacking the oil fields by air just for that same reason, to try to cut down on their income. But what they are also doing is collecting taxes.
Yes.
If you run a company, or you run a store, or you run anything else, they come in and say, okay, you're going to pay us X dinars a month. And in many cases, the store owner says, hey, that's not too bad. I paid 2X to Assad, so it's a good deal. Okay. Well, of course, his option was to get his head cut off also, so he was probably pretty amenable to whatever they were going to tell him. So they are getting money from all of the companies that are running things, and they have installed their own people, or else they insisted that the previous management stay and run the operation, which they had done with the oil fields, water, dams, things like that, which are fairly complicated. You have to have technically proficient people to administer them. Same way with a hospital, for example. So anyway, okay, then they get money from kidnapping. They get money. They've sold some of these antiquities, some of the ones they didn't smash. They have sold them. Kidnapping is a good way, extortion, stealing, banks, other places. They have managed to put a budget together. This is a real operation. They have a budget that has a $250 million surplus for American operations and cases and so on. So they have put together a state. They've divided the area up into 16 wilayats, which are pretty much the same as the old provinces. There are 9 in Iraq and 7 in Syria. And each one of those has an emir who is in charge. He's in charge of all of the administrative operations as well as military operations. He has a shura council, which advises him and helps him on everything. So this is an organized group. This is not like an insurgency. This is an organized group. Now, we're disrupting them, but that doesn't stop it. You're going to have to take them out, and that's not going to be easy.
Boy, those are really very intriguing, informative comments there. You know, I was looking again at this article by Scott Bronstein and Drew Griffin, CNN Investigations, for October 7, 2014. They reference the monies coming in from crops in the Syrian area. I guess they're saying that in terms of Raqqa, their capital, or de facto capital, as they note, and quoting directly, they also control sort of the breadbasket of Syria. Further citing, they've got the cotton and the wheat and all these other things. All of these serve as sort of economic and powerhouse or funding for ISIS. They mention here, they were mentioning when they actually took over bank monies. Of course, they're terrorists and criminals, so I'm not surprised. Here it is. Quote, in Mosul, ISIS looted the central bank and other smaller provincial banks, resulting in a financial windfall of tens and possibly hundreds of millions of dollars, end quotes. But now, Colonel Hobbs, I'm confused. When you mention tax, that would be like a form of extortion. Does this at all relate to the jizla? Did I remember that term correctly? Or is that just a tax that's placed on non-Muslim peoples?
Well, they may be doing some jizya, but that jizya is strictly something you do with the Christians. The tax I'm talking about is on the Muslim business owners, store owners, just like they would pay it to Assad or the prime minister or the government in Baghdad. So, you know, everybody would be paying taxes. So they're collecting taxes. They're collecting this money.
That's very interesting information. Thank you. Thank you for clarifying my understanding there, Colonel Hobbs. You know, also next, before we go into the characteristics of Islam. Oh, you know, I'm sorry. On a tangent here, I was very intrigued by reports that ISIS or ISIS-linked groups had attempted to infiltrate the border of Saudi Arabia. Some articles are also referencing that Saudi Arabia is constructing a wall around a portion of its border. This was from a Newsweek.com article, ISIS attack Saudi border post and infiltrate town. Have you heard any information there about the Saudis being very concerned about ISIS?
Oh, yes, they are, and they're working on that border up there. They've done the same thing in the south. They have built a 1,100-kilometer berm or wall next to Yemen. And you've noticed the problems recently with Yemen, with the Houthis, who are Shia Muslims who have taken over the government in Sana. So, yes, they have put up a berm. They're very concerned about their northern border. It's not that far up to Mosul, and it's a straight line down into Saudi Arabia. There's not much there. It's just empty desert, most of it, but it's very concerning to the Saudis. They are worrying about that very much, yes. One thing you haven't gotten into yet, I assume you want to get into at some point, is
yes.
The question about all of this damage that they've been doing of destroying everything that's going. Do you want to come to that at some point?
Yes, please. Yes. You mean the artifacts, the historical artifacts, priceless...
Yes.
Yes, indeed. Priceless artifacts, also ancient buildings. Yes, sir. Please, more details on that. That would be fascinating.
Well, you want to talk about that?
Yes, sir.
Okay. This is pure Islam again. Everyone is... All of our wonderful people are constantly telling us that the Islamic State is not Islamic. Well, I wish like they would read some of the history. But anyway, do you remember the Bamiyan Buddhas in Afghanistan?
Yes.
They got blown up. It's the same thing. What this is, it's another word, another good Arabic word, it's Jahiliya. J-I-H-I-L-I-Y-Y-A, Jahiliya. Jahiliya means ignorance. And it's a principle that Muhammad established that everything or anything before Islam is the time of ignorance and has no value and should be destroyed. When the Arabs came flying out of Arabia after the death of Muhammad and they got to Cairo, or what was the main city of that area, in 634, a number of them wanted to destroy the pyramids because they are idols, and they don't like idols. Allah told them to destroy all idols. There's no idolatry. Well, they didn't know how to destroy the pyramid. That was too big a job. What's very interesting, in 2012, when the Muslim Brotherhood took over in Egypt, there was talk again of destroying the pyramids. This is Jahiliya. So this is what's going on. They're destroying the museums, the libraries, books, the thousands of year old great manuscripts, mosques, even Sunni mosques. One of the mosques is supposedly the tomb of Jonah. Jonah is in the Bible.
Right. Mm-hmm.
But he's also in the Quran. Like Abraham and Jesus and others, they're also in the Quran. And they don't like, or did not like, the idea of this mosque representing or portraying Jonah. You'll notice that when King Abdullah died in Saudi Arabia, he's buried in an unmarked grave.
Yes.
They do not have marks for grave. So they destroyed a Sunni mosque. It was blown up last August. So they blew that thing up. So... And then the libraries. There's no book that's of any value except the Quran. Well, that doesn't make for a very good engineer, but okay. So anyway, they're destroying these things. And this ancient stuff that is in these museums, in the great museum in Mosul, they just went in and broke it all up. They destroyed the main library in Mosul, and then the library at the university in Mosul. So... And the number of mosques, Shiite mosques, of course, they go right away. But even some Sunni mosques, but the Shiite ones, they're by definition of no value. And you blow them up. This is the true Islam. I mean, you just can't get around it. This is not a bunch of wackos off on a tangent. Abu Bakr has a doctorate in Islamic studies from Saddam Hussein University in Baghdad. I think he knows more about Islam than some of our politicians.
Well, you know, the destruction of centers of learning, books, historical places, historical artifacts is horrible. But I'd like to also mention the destruction of, well, you can't destroy the human soul, but think of the lives which have been so horribly impacted by ISIS. You know, you have, I remember reading an article very recently by a young soldier who wants to join the Christian armies there against ISIS because he was so horrified as to what was happening to some of the young Christian girls who were kidnapped, the atrocities that have happened to them. That is such a horrible, horrible impact on a life and a civilization.
Well, the whole business of the treatment of women is just, you know, it's disgusting. The Yazidi women, which is a special sect of women, and that sect is up in the area to the west of Mosul. And when they came in there last summer, they captured these people. A lot of them tried to get north into the mountain and escape. But the ones that they captured, these girls and women, were sold off as sex slaves. They were running slave markets, and then they put those on video also. We have videos of slave markets and people bidding on them, and then they sell them, and then they sell them to somebody else, and they sell them to the next person and move them around. It's even gotten to the point where one of the girls who escaped reported that they were being used also for blood transfusions for wounded soldiers of the Daesh. So it's very discouraging. You know, there's the Al-Qamsa Brigade, which is a woman's brigade, and they've been controlling things, and a bunch of women were stopped for not wearing their veil, and they put acid on their faces. They cut off some women's hands for using a cell phone. And of course, we've had the stoning of women, supposedly for adultery, but for whatever reason, they put them in a hole and cover them up and then stone them to death. So the treatment of women is one of those really black marks on Islam, because that is also Islamic and in the history.
Those are such strong comments. Thank you, Colonel Hobbs. Also, on a side note here, now, those brave troops, the Peshmerga, the Kurds, have been valiantly fighting against ISIS. Our Senator McCain of Arizona wants the Peshmerga to receive arms from the United States, and there's a great article at thefiscaltimes.com, posted January 27, 2015, entitled, McCain, Get Ready, U.S. Troops Ground Iraq and Syria. I hope that's the full title and not just the description here in the URL. Do you think that's a very good piece of advice, that the Peshmerga should be fully armed by us, or not fully armed by us, but receive important armaments from us, important weapons?
Well, they need more weapons, and they haven't been getting them, because we've been sending everything that we send over there. We've been sending it through the central government in Baghdad, and Baghdad has not been passing it on to the Kurds in the north, because they've always been at loggerheads, and they've been at loggerheads over the distribution of the oil revenues. And then, of course, they don't get along anyway. The country is badly divided into a Shia southeast, a Sunni center, and a Kurdish north. And so they have not gotten their fair share of things. It was very interesting. There's another one of these great videos that their media company can put out, and it showed 21 Peshmerga prisoners in cages on the back of pickup trucks being paraded through a city. These clowns have some kind of a thing about cages, but anyway, these were in cages, and very discouraging to see this sort of thing.
Indeed. I think I saw some of those photos of myself. They were really horrific. And, well, you know, we're coming up with 3 more minutes before the end of the program. I don't know if this is too much of an aside. I was noticing that Senator Lindsey Graham of California believes that the American people should know the details of our negotiations with Iran. And also, Iran in its own right is a tremendous, do you think it also is a tremendous Muslim threat? And how do you think Iran will play out as regards ISIS?
we're in the very difficult and unusual and embarrassing position right now of being basically allied with Iran in the effort against Daesh, because General Qasem Soleimani, who is the head of the Quds Force, which is the fighting part of the Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps, which was set up by Ayatollah Khomeini after he took power. Soleimani has been in Iraq regularly and publicly. He's been around before, but he always used to try to keep it secret. Well, now it's very public. And again, there today, he's up there in the fight to try to get back Tikrit. He's working with and probably has, I'm sure he goes nowhere without a lot of troops. He has people leading the Shia militias, which are separate from the Iraqi army. So you've got the Iraqi army, you got Shia militias, you got Iranian groups. It's getting very complicated. And we're working against ISIS. Now, they don't like Daesh, ISIS, because that's Sunni. Don't forget, now, the Persians, the Iranians, are Shia. So you got this terrible divide. They don't like each other, and they're ready to kill each other, which is one of the great jokes about Islam, because it's so badly divided, but that's a different story. So anyway, yes, the Iranians have the nuclear idea. I don't think they'll ever give up that idea. They might postpone it. The whole reason to have a nuclear weapon is prestige. When you have nuclear weapons, you are in a different category of countries. It just takes you out and moves you up into the nuclear club, and you get treated differently. People don't want to attack you quite as easily, so it's an enormous thing. The Israelis, to them, it's an existential threat, because every day some Iranian saying, we want to kill all the Israelis, let's blow it off the map. And this goes back to Khomeini, it goes back to all of them. Ahmadinejad regularly said, you know, we should blow Israel off the map. Well, if you're in Israel, you kind of take that seriously. In Washington, you may not take it seriously, but if you're an Israeli, you sure do. So they are very concerned, and they're very concerned that the U.S. is going to make some kind of a deal which is going to end up with a nuclear weapon system in Iran, and that scares the Israelis to death. So they are very upset, and they're willing to push the U.S.-Israeli relationship right up to the edge, which is what Bibi Netanyahu did when he went to Congress on the 3rd of March.
You know, Colonel Hobbs, your comments, your information this evening have been so helpful to me in my understanding of the situation, and I know our listeners very much appreciate your comments. Please be a return guest again. I know we're coming up to just before the next program, which is Flipside Light, our news program with co-hosts Stephanie Benetti and Joe Montaldo on Saturday evening. Excellent program. That will be a two-hour program tonight. On Saturday evening, Colonel Hobbs, this particular tape will replay at 11:10 p.m. That will be after News on the Flip Side, again with Stephanie Benetti and Joe Montaldo as great co-hosts, and that will be a three-hour program for either 3 or 4 hour. I'm saying now 10 minutes after 11 p.m. Eastern as to when I think this program will be rebroadcast as well, and I'm sure thereafter many times. Now I'd like to again reference your great website, coldoc.com, for excellent articles and chapters from all of your books. They're all excellent, very well worth the read. And, sir, do you have any closing comments?
Well, thank you very much. I enjoyed it. The cruelty is there. I wrote a piece not too long ago, and I said, wrong enemy, wrong goal, wrong tactics, wrong strategy. And I think we need to think hard about what we're going to do and what the position of the United States is. And we need to stop tolerating the intolerable. Thank you very much.
Thank you, sir. Good night, everyone. And listeners, thank you for joining us. Great evening, everyone.
I could not have pictured myself dragging my